13 and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here and be sober tonight. And I'd like to welcome anybody who's new or relatively new to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard it said in my first meeting that I never had to pick up another drink for the rest of my life 24 hours at a time. And there was this old guy around, his name was Tom Woods, and he's passed away since then. And he used to say that all the time, every meeting I went to. He'd say, I'd like to welcome our new friends to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and let you know that you never have to pick up another drink for the rest of your life 24 hours at a time. And there was a lot to that statement, and I used to wonder why it was he said that over and over and over and over and over again. And I think it was because my pea brain couldn't absorb all the little pieces of that for a little while. It took me a while. And the first thing that I noticed about that statement was that he said he'd like to welcome our new friends. And he met me, and it had been a long time since anybody had looked at me like that. And then he said to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what that told me was that that you guys had a fellowship in here where we come together with a common purpose, and everybody's welcome. And that was a big deal for me, too. And then he told me that I never had a drink again for the rest of my life, and that's when my ears closed. Because that wasn't the solution that I was looking for from you. I thought it would work for a little while, but I wasn't real sure that I was going to stick around here. And then he said that I never had to pick up another drink for the rest of my life. And what I heard there was, how come I drank? And I never realized that until I had heard him say it every day for 5 years, that the reason I drank was because I had to. And that rang true for me. So I don't know if I'm going to do a whole hour or not, or 45 minutes, but we'll give it a shot. I'll tell you a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I was born at the age of four. No, I'm just kidding. I was born in West Virginia, and my mother and my stepfather moved cross-country with me when I was little. And from the time we landed, I remember here, we ended up in Southern California. I remember feeling different. You know, I started school, and we were in this little upper middle class beach community in Southern California. And my perception of the way things were supposed to be was that I was supposed to have blonde hair, blue eyes, and tan skin, and look like all the rest of you and fit in. And that wasn't the case for me. I was a foot taller than everybody else in my class. I had red stringy hair, buck teeth, and freckles, and it didn't look like the Pamela Anderson Baywatch kind of thing that I figured was supposed to be happening. And I just felt different. It's funny, it seems like every meeting that I've ever been to, I hear people talk about feeling different. And what I realized today is that difference came from self-centered fear. And it came in that form at 6 and 7 and 8 years old before I ever found a drink of alcohol. So I believe that, not that it matters because everybody believes different things, I believe that I was an alcoholic a long time before I found booze. But I just felt different, and I remember going to school and not fitting in. I didn't feel pretty enough, and I didn't feel smart enough, and I didn't feel good enough, and I wasn't educated enough, and everywhere in my life that I looked for this standard that I was supposed to uphold, my perception was that I didn't meet it, and I didn't much care for that. I started drinking when I was around 12 years old. A friend of mine and I cut school, and we went over to her house, and we locked ourselves in and started drinking her mom's scotch. I remember taking a drink from that bottle, and all of those insecurities and all of that fear that I felt kind of just melted. I was thinking about the analogy of like a slinky, you know, those springy slinky things. And before I found alcohol, I felt like the slinky that your little brother got hold of that was tied in knots and twisted and turned and would never again resemble the thing that it was supposed to look like. And when I found a drink, all of those twists and turns just kind of went away and nothing mattered anymore. I hated the taste, but I remember what it felt like going down, and I got this warm glow and the top of my head blew off because we were drinking scotch straight out of the bottle, and, you know, I got that glow going on in my fingertips and my toes got funny, and what I realized was that I had found the solution that I had been looking for all my life. My mom has a picture of me when I was a kid. I was 2 or 3 years old, and I was sitting on my Uncle Beaner's lap. I'm from West Virginia. You have to be from West Virginia to have an Uncle Beaner. But I was sitting on his lap, and he was feeding me this Olympia beer. And I guess my face was beet red, and I was running around being the life of the party. And I don't remember that, obviously. But I read a line in the doctor's opinion that says we're irritable, restless, and discontented unless we can again recapture the sense of ease and comfort which came after we took a drink. And so the only thing that I could figure is I knew that ease and comfort at 3, and I was restless, irritable, discontent until I hit my next drink. And that just kind of described those years in between when I was growing up. And so we were at that house, and we were drinking that scotch, and I remember vaguely getting really sick in places I wasn't supposed to get really sick. And my mom caught us ditching school and came banging on the door, and we jumped out the back window and took off with the scotch bottle, and we were running around finishing and hiding and doing whatever we were doing. And about 4 o'clock that afternoon, I knew that the only logical solution to the problem that I found myself in was to take her 9-year-old brother and run away from home. So I did. And, you know, there's nothing remarkable about that. The reason that I tell that story is because that kind of describes the way that I drank every time I drank. I drank a lot, and I threw up all over where I shouldn't have. And I had large gaps in my memory banks of things that I didn't remember. And anything that popped into my head seemed like a logical thing for me to go do, and I did it. So I kind of lost the ability to think rationally about what I was going to do. And, you know, by the 11 o'clock that night, I was in East L.A. and 12 years old with a little boy crying and didn't know what to do. So I called the cops and went home, and I was in a lot of trouble, and I took him in a lot of trouble right along with me, and that was just kind of the pattern of my life until I found Alcoholics Anonymous. And then sometimes that was the pattern of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober for a long time, and some of my story resembles a drunkalogue without the alcohol. I mean, I'd like to tell you that's not the case, but sometimes that's just the case. So anyways, I love the effect that alcohol had on me, and there's a part in the doctor's opinion, too. I love the big book. You'll know that in a minute. There's a part in the doctor's opinion that says that we drink essentially because we like the effect that's produced by alcohol, and that after a while, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one, that we can't differentiate the true from the false. And that happened really, really quickly for me. I drank every time that I could. And anything that got in the way with me taking a drink had to go away. And so I did really poorly in school, and I drank myself into and out of a lot of different little peer groups and friends. And I drank myself into and out of every relationship that I ever was in. And in the 10th grade, what I realized was that school wasn't happening. Wasn't where I thought I needed to be. And so I would show up to school in the morning, and my kids are here, so I should probably be careful. But I would show up to school in the morning, stop at the bleachers, do what I wasn't supposed to do, and then I would have to leave before my English class, which was first period, thinking that I would come back a little later, which I never did. So by the time I got halfway through the 10th grade, I realized that you needed credits in order to progress on to the next grade, and I didn't have any. So I took the GED, and I got out of school with the intention of going to college because I was just so much smarter than the average bear. That was another thing that was really characteristic of the way that I looked at myself. On one hand, I was full of self-centered fear. I was inferior. I was not enough. And on the other hand, I thought, like it says in the big book, that I could float above the rest of you on my brain power alone. And my sponsor's husband says that what we are is egomaniacs with inferiority complexes, and I love that because that describes me. There's a lot of things that are complete opposite that both hold true in my life. So anyways, I quit school, and I went to El Camino College, and I was doing the little community college thing, and I landed myself an amazing job that I thought was just right along my career path. And I was 16, 17 years old, and I ended up working the drive-thru window at the local Burger King in Redondo Beach. And so I was hanging out there doing my thing, and one day this Marine Corps recruiter came in, and he was standing at the counter, and I was not in my right mind, and I turned around to take his order and let him know that I always wanted to join the Army. And for those of you that know anything about Marines, they don't like that. I didn't understand which uniform he was wearing, and it kind of insulted him a little bit. But nevertheless, he ended up with my phone number and called me every morning at 7 o'clock until he convinced me to come into his office. And by some strange twist and circumstances, I ended up in the Navy at 17 years old. And I went off to boot camp, and we landed there. I was in Orlando, Florida, in the Recruits and Processing Barracks on the 24th of December in 1981. And I couldn't quite figure out what had happened. And I thought there had been just this huge misunderstanding. We could talk it over. You would see my way, and then I'd leave. And they didn't, and so I didn't either. And I stayed there, and I ended up getting in a lot of trouble when I was in boot camp because I got drunk. And I don't know a lot of people that pull that off, but I figured out how to drink when I was in boot camp, and they caught me. And I almost didn't graduate with my company. I met the commanding officer of the recruit section of the base in Orlando, Florida. I almost got kicked out. And I was 17 years old, and I was really sorry for what I did. And I was afraid, and, you know, I didn't want to do that. But I did it anyway, and he just kind of knew that, I think. And he let me stay. And I did what I needed to do to get myself out of trouble, which was a really ugly thing. And I graduated with my company, and during the time, the job that I had picked and they agreed to let me have was in naval intelligence. And so while I was in boot camp getting in this trouble, I had the FBI and all of these people running around my neighborhood doing all of these background checks to give me all of the security clearances that I would need in order to do my job. And you know, I've heard so many times that God looks out for fools and drunks, and I was a fool and a drunk, so he was looking out double for me, and by some strange coincidence, they didn't catch anything that stopped them from giving me that clearance. And I went off to school in Pensacola, Florida, and I was doing the deal, and I decided one day, they were having this big party out in the quad of the barracks area, and I was on duty that weekend, all weekend, so I wasn't allowed to be there with them. And my friends felt really sorry for me, so they were filling up my 7-Up can with this stuff that they called Mojo, which, among fruit juice and Everclear, I have no idea what else is in there. But it was really good, and it kind of tasted like fruit punch, and I drank a little bit more than I should have. And I ended up leaving base and getting in an accident on the 3-mile bridge going to Pensacola Beach. And I got in a lot of trouble. And I went up before the captain. I seemed to meet the captains of all of my bases in ways that weren't good. Normally, you could meet them at breakfast in the chow hall and go, "Good morning, sir. Nice day, isn't it?" and go on about your business. But they knew me in a little bit of a different light. So anyways, I met this man, and I was really sorry, and I didn't want to do that. I had my whole career in front of me, and I was like, you know, and I got off. I did some restriction time and lost some of my money for a little while and set back into another class, and I ended up graduating, and they sent me to ADAC, Alaska, to the Naval Security Group activity. ADAC's a little Aleutian island off the Kamchatka Strait in Russia. And it was 82-ish, 81 during the Cold War era. So we were there doing what people in naval intelligence do. And I drank a lot when I was on that island. And there were some barracks that were attached by underground tunnels because the weather wasn't really good. And attached to those underground tunnels, there was the chow hall, the bowling alley, the ceramic shop, and the EM club. And I didn't like to bowl, and ceramics were never my thing, so I hung out at the EM club a lot. And the neat thing was, is I got 12-stepped during that period. I met up with our command counselor, and I had gotten in trouble, and they had me on antabuse. I was going to those A&A meetings, and I was listening to this little counselor, and I didn't like him very much. His name was Mike, and he was this little weasel-looking thing, and he was an alcoholic. He went to AA, and I didn't realize it at the time, but he would ask me really weird questions, like, do you ever have memory lapses as a result of your drinking? And I told him, everybody that I know has memory lapses as a result of their drinking. And he said, then everybody you know is an alcoholic. And I thought that was just the most preposterous thing I'd ever heard in my life. And I was 18 years old, and I couldn't quite grasp what it was he was trying to tell me. So I got in a little more trouble, and I did some really bizarre things that kind of made them think I was crazy. And they sent me to the Nut Ward in Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage, and I spent a couple weeks in there. Real nice counselors, good food, nifty styrofoam PJ slipper thingies, and nice people. You know, I loved it in there, and I did those little MMPI tests, and they told me I was a little bit passive-aggressive, and I had these tendencies and whatever, and then they sent me back to Alaska. And I was still taking antabuse, and I drank again. I don't suggest that. But, you know, it's funny. They tell you that you're going to take this, and if you drink alcohol with it, you're going to get really, really sick. So don't drink no matter what you do. Don't use toothpaste with alcohol in it. Watch what kind of perfume you wear because you're going to break out. You're going to be really sensitive to alcohol. And, you know, you could swallow your tongue and die. You could go into seizures. It's bad. And I, like, filed that away for future reference and thought that I would try beer. And I got really, really sick. And 2 days later, I went to my little CAC counseling appointment, and my counselor looked at me. I had red blotches all over myself. I was, like, swollen and deformed looking. And he looked at me and said, "What happened?" And I told him that I thought my friend had the chicken pox, and, you know, it's amazing some of the dumb stuff that we come up with, and obviously he had known what happened, and he ended up medevacking me to a rehab in Philadelphia at the Naval Regional Medical Center, and I went in there and learned a lot of really nifty stuff. You know, people that go through rehabs learn good stuff, and I learned good stuff. I thought what they were looking for was for me to tell them, like, I hated my mother, and my father left me, and I felt so abandoned, and the Navy did me wrong, and I had no idea what they wanted me to look at was my relationship with alcohol, and it wasn't some place that I was willing to go, and so as a result, I didn't finish that rehab. They had started crushing my antabuse tablets and water and making me drink it because I used to hide it under my tongue and spit it out. And while I was in that rehab, I was drinking the antabuse, and then we went to this Phillies game, and my friend and I thought we'd try beer again because, you know, it didn't work so good last time. Maybe this time would be a little better, and we went and got one of those big beers, and he was like 6'4", so he chugged half of it, and I chugged half of it, and we just made it back to our chairs, and I got really red and flushed and hot and wasn't feeling too good, and before I could get up to go to the bathroom, I got sick, and I projectile vomit when I drink on antabuse. And so the only way that I know how to make amends for that is to let you know that if in 1983 you were ever in the Philly Stadium watching a game and something hit you in the back of the head, I am really sorry. I know one of these days I'm going to be in a meeting and somebody's going to come up to me afterwards, but hasn't happened yet. So anyways, I got kicked out of that rehab, and my warped perception thought that the reason they were asking me to leave that rehab is because there was only one room with four beds for women, and then this big open bay for men, and these other girls came in, and they were short of bed, and they were making me leave, which more than likely wasn't the case, but that's the way that I saw it at the time. So I left and I went over to the naval station in Philly, and I had sworn when I left there that I wasn't going to drink. I was going to just do whatever I had to do to not drink. I was going to go beg the commanding officer of the base over there to let me stay. I'd do anything. I was committed no matter what. I was going to save my military career. I loved being a sailor. I loved the job that I was doing. And I really did not want to leave the military. And my counselor told me on the way out of there, he caught me as I was leaving, and he told me, if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous, but you won't. You'll die drunk. And I'd been to some meetings in that rehab, and I had every intention of going over, checking into the BEQ, and then going over and going. There was this Alano Club thing in Philly. It was called the Neighborhood Club, and there were really neat meetings, and there was this real nasty woman named Alice that I was going to ask to be my sponsor because you guys told me that I should probably have one of those. And somewhere in between checking into that BEQ and noon, I was in the EM club pitching quarters and drunk on Anabuse one more time, and I have no idea how that happened. I swear to God that no matter what, I was not going to pick up that drink, and I was as committed as I had ever been. And it talks about that in the doctor's opinion, and it wasn't until later when I came in here that I found out that that's the disease of alcoholism, that we lose control over the amount that we drink and over whether we're going to drink. And it says, you know, that we alcoholics lose the power of choice and drink. And that happened to me. I obviously didn't save my military career, and I spent from July of 83 when I was separated to October of 84 doing every nasty, rotten, horrible, messed up thing I swore I would never do that separated me from you guys. I got back to Southern California, and I decimated my mother. I broke her heart. I robbed her house. I did things I swore I would never tell another human being. And I ended up living in this little two-seater MG Midget for the last couple months before I got sober. And I used to drive down to the bar. There was this bar in Redondo Beach or Hermosa Beach called the Pitcher House. It was this old beer joint with sawdust on the floor to soak up when you get sick, like my kind of bar. And I would go in there, and my friends would be in there, and then I would turn around, and they'd be gone. So I'd suck down my pitcher of beer and go across the street to the Hermosa Saloon to find them. And as I walked in the front door, they'd walk out the back and go back across the street. And what I found out later was that they just didn't want to be around me when I was drinking. And I was told when I was new in here that alcoholism is a lonely disease. And I was alone at the end of my drinking. I joke about living in that little car. I was 5'10" and 120 pounds when I sobered up. And, you know, they're kind of little, those cars. And I didn't have a motor home. I had a motor townhouse or something. And I had a little trunk in the trunk that had all my worldly possessions in it, and I would sit in that car and just drink. And I guess somewhere around October 9th is the closest my sponsor and I could come up with a date. I was sitting there with a nice big bottle of vodka in the seat next to me, and I was drinking, and it just wasn't working. It wouldn't shut off this anymore, and it wouldn't numb the feelings that I had anymore. And for a long time, I think alcohol saved my sanity, and it was the only solution that I had ever known in my life. It made my skin fit properly, and it made me okay with all of the things that I felt about myself. If I could drink, they'd just shut up for a minute. And none of that was happening. I was drinking that vodka, and I was getting nothing from it. And there's another part in the big book that talks about being at that jumping off place when we can't imagine a life with alcohol or without it. And I didn't realize at the time that I was at that jumping off place, but it described it perfectly once I was willing to do what you said and pick that book up. So I was sitting in that car, and I was drinking that vodka, and just like that little counselor was sitting in the seat next to me, I heard somebody say, if you ever want to get sober, you call Alcoholics Anonymous. But you won't. You'll die drunk. And, you know, they talked a lot when I was new here about moments of clarity, having that moment of clarity. And there was something about that. I mean, it was bizarre because there was obviously nobody in that car with me. Nobody would get in my car with me. But I heard him. His name was Jim, just like he was sitting there. And I went over to a payphone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a little guy named Sam that worked at our central office in Southern California. And I put on my best I'm okay voice because I had to fool you, you know. And I said, like Jim told me I should, tell him you're an alcoholic and you're looking for AA and they'll do anything to help you. And I said, so I'm Tina and I'm an alcoholic and I'm looking for a meeting. And Sam covered up the mouthpiece and said to Eunice, who was our manager of our central office, we got a live one here. Let's send her to Birch. And I don't know how he figured that out. I thought I was like pulling it off. You know, all my life I had been able to pull it off and just I wasn't able to do that anymore. And they directed me to this little Alano Club in Hawthorne called the Southwest Alano Club. And I walked into this 5:30 meeting and I sat down in the front and I wasn't in real good shape. I weighed 120 pounds and I had just enough bile in my hair to pass as highlights. And I wasn't eating real regularly. My eyes were all sunk in the back of my head. I was, you know, 5'10 and 120 is not good. I was really, really skinny. And my eyes were sunk in the back of my head. I had big black bags under them. And I had on this T-shirt that I bought for a buck at the Salvation Army in Salt Lake City. And it stunk really, really bad. I had that acrid kind of stench going on that it takes a month to wash off. You know, the kind that's just in your pores, and only a good alcoholic knows what that smells like. But it was not in good condition. And I had on these little pants with a big hole in the butt end of my jeans. And I walked in there, and I sat down in the front with the little pad of paper that I had stolen from the grocery store, and I was writing the steps down because I didn't have $5 to buy your big book. And this lady walked up to me, and she grabbed my paper, and she scribbled across the front of it, having admitted to our innermost selves that we're real alcoholics, this is the first step in recovery. And the first instinct that I had was to hit her, because that's what I knew how to do when I got sober, was hit you. And what that did was kept you at a distance. It kept you from getting too close. It kept you from invading. And, you know. And so I didn't hit her. I didn't look at her real nice, and I probably wasn't really nice to her, but she ended up being my sponsor a little bit later. But I hung out in that meeting, and you guys gave me a big book, and I heard that guy Tom say that I never had to drink again for the rest of my life a day at a time. And what you guys told me was to keep coming here, no matter what. So I hung out at that Alano Club. I didn't have anywhere else to go, so I parked my car behind it in the little hidden parking. And they'd come out at 6 in the morning and wake me up and bring me in for the 6:45 meeting, and the secretary would get me just early enough that I could come in and wash my face and clean up a little bit. He'd buy me extra donuts so I didn't have to eat half of a donut. He'd give me a couple because it's all I was eating. And I'd sit through that 6:45 meeting, and then I'd hang out at that club until 11:30. And then all the guys from Northrop would come into the noon meeting, and we'd have an 11:30 to 1 afternoon meeting. And then I'd hang out in that Alano Club. And then those same guys would come back at 5:30 before they hit the traffic jam to go home, and I'd sit through the 5:30 meeting. And then there was the 8:30 meeting, and I'd hang out for that one. And normally they'd bring great speakers in and have some more cookies and whatever, And then we'd all go out to the coffee shop at 10 o'clock after that meeting. And we'd sit there at the coffee shop until about 2 when everybody took off and went home. And then I'd climb in my car and go back behind that Alano Club and sleep for a couple hours and get up and do it again. And what I found when I was new here was that I was immersed in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was, I get choked up. It was the most amazing experience I'd ever had in my life. And the thing that moves me the most about this program is how well you guys loved me when I was new here. 'Cause I was unlovable. I was, in my own mind, discardable. I was a discardable thing. And no matter what I ever did in here, you guys never made me leave. Sometimes you took me outside the meeting and gave me stern talkings to, but then you would bring me back in and sit back down with me. I never was asked to leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what you told me to do was to keep coming back no matter what I did. And I would cuss at you from your podium, and I'd punch you to say hi because I didn't know how to hug you, and I would just do bizarre things. And you'd clap no matter what I did and tell me to keep coming back. And so I did. This is the only place for a long time that I had been welcome. After a little while, I was 20 when I got sober. And at the Solano Club, everybody in there was 70 or 80. It's kind of the way it looked. I mean, it really did, you know. It's funny, I was talking to our new friend that just moved up here from Southern California, and we had some of the same heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were old, you know. Even then, Clancy was old. But they loved me anyway, and they wanted me to stay. And after a while, they elected this woman. She must have drawn the short straw or something, but they elected her to take me into the meeting room in between the meetings and read the big book with me. And what she told me was that we were going to read this book, and that if I was to stay here, I had to read that book with her, and that if I was going to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, that she wanted to make sure that I availed myself to everything that was here for me. And given that I'm selfish and self-centered to the extreme, I thought, if there's anything to be had here, let's have it. So I sat down with really messed up motives and listened to her read that book with me. And she'd go through a couple lines, and then she'd stop, and she'd say, "So do you understand that, honey?" And I'd go, "No." And she'd explain it to me in a way that was okay, that could penetrate that fog, you know. And we would read that book, and she would point out the fact that it said, "Look right here, it says we are 100 men and women who have recovered. That means what we do is we get better in here, honey. We don't stay the same." And I thought, okay. So, you know, gently, oh so gently, she tricked me into working the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she did that first by showing me what the disease was. And it's all in the doctor's opinion. If we read in that doctor's opinion, it says there's different types of alcoholics. There's the psychopathic kind or whatever. There's the manic depressive kind, and there's all these different kinds. She goes, "Which kind are you?" And I was a little bit of all of them. And she goes, "That's a really neat thing, because what we get to do is we relate in here. And if you can find yourself in that big book, we gotcha." I don't know that I liked her saying that, but they had me. Want me or not, they had me. And then we got to step two, and, you know, it was easy back on one to realize that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable. My life was a train wreck. And my life had been a train wreck for a long, long time. And I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. But like I said, it was the only solution that I had known for a long time. And so when I came in here and you told me that I couldn't drink, I wasn't sure that was what I was looking for. But I was willing to stay just long enough to check it out. And I did. So we got to step two. And it talks about coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And I didn't have an issue with the insanity idea. It made perfect sense to me. It explained things that I could never explain before I got here. It was all good. I know today that there's a lot of people that take issue with that. And what they did was they pointed out to me the part in the book that says that alcohol is only a symptom. And, you know, that we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows, and I could see that. I thought differently than most people did, and I still do. I've been sober for a long time, and I still think differently than most people do. But what you guys do is teach me today that what I think doesn't necessarily have to be the way that it really is. And sometimes my perception of reality is just a little bit skewed. When I was new here, I didn't want to talk about that whole God idea. So I conceded that I was insane and then skipped the rest of step two and three. Actually, what you guys did was you taught me that I could use the group of Alcoholics Anonymous as a higher power because you were staying sober and I didn't know how. And that worked for me for a long time. And so I came to your meetings and I did that and I made my sponsor my God for a little while. And let me tell you, when she came crashing off of her throne, it was an ugly picture. In my mind, it didn't hurt her much, but for me, it was ugly. After a little while, you made me do an inventory, and I wrote down all of that stuff, and I thought that that inventory was supposed to be this horrific thing, you know, and it wasn't that bad. You guys have all done them, you know. It's a series of lists and prayers and reflections and some more lists and fears and whatever, and it's done. But what it did was it took that stigma of all the stuff that I thought made me who I was, and I got to see that I wasn't so unique, and sharing it with another person was awesome, because what happened was I told them all of that stuff and they didn't make me leave. And all my life, I had to leave. You know, if you weren't making me leave, I was leaving because you were getting ready to make me leave. And it was just like this never-ending whirlwind going on in my head. And she didn't throw me away. She let me stay. Step 6 and 7 taught me that that my character defects don't make me. You know, I didn't think I had any. I thought I didn't smell good and I drank too much when I came here, but I didn't see where I was that bad of a person. But what I got to do with step 6 is look at those character defects and see where they harm me in my life. And I love the part in the 12 and 12 that talks about, you know, having the big glaring ones, we're obviously really willing to let God have them. But when we look at the little ones that don't hurt us too much, you know, sometimes they're comfortable. And I don't know about you guys, but I don't participate in a defective character unless I get something out of it. And sometimes I get something out of my defects. When I get just a little bit angry, it's a great defense mechanism. Makes you take a step back, and I don't get confronted too much because sometimes people are scared to do that. And, you know, I get a little bit judgmental, and I get to feel better about myself for a minute. And so when I do those things, today what I know is what it costs me, and so I'm a little bit less willing to do that. And step 7 says that I humbly ask God to remove those defects. And I told you I wasn't doing those God steps, so I figured now that I knew them and I was aware of this stuff, we would just deal with it, you and I, and we'd go on about our business. And I worked the 8 and 9 steps, and I made those amends, and I, you know, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have set me free. I love working with other people. The thing that I want the most in my life is to know God better and to grow in the image and likeness of my Creator. It says in the book that that we're going to place ourselves where we could be of maximum service to God and our fellows. And I do that today because you guys taught me how, not because I'm so virtuous and I can do that, but because God's turned me into something that He can use, and it was all not of my own doing. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love, I tell people all the time that I hate to sponsor people, but I don't. I don't like to sponsor people because what happens is I get close in a relationship with people, and my defects rear their ugly little head, and I can't control the way that you work your fourth step, and I can't make you do it on my timetable, and I'm not certain whether you got it or not, so I'm a little bit out of control. And I get a little bit closer than I normally do, so I'm open to being hurt. But what I find is that vulnerability is where the juice in all of my life is. You know, when I can open myself up and lay myself out, warts and all, it's a great thing. You know, there's so much that's available in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that I would work the 12 steps and then I would be done. And maybe I might work in with somebody else, and maybe I wouldn't, and then I would just hang out here forever, and this would just be the way that it was. And I've been complacent in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had to come back and redo stuff. What I found was, and it says this in the book, I love it, that the purpose of the program is to put you in touch with a power greater than yourself that can fix all your problems, can solve all your problems. Not just the problem that I had with alcohol, not just the problem that I had with living in my car. I've learned how to do everything that I do right here with you guys. I didn't know how to color coordinate my clothing when I got sober. I didn't know how to clean a house. I didn't know how to communicate, to talk with you, to be open with you. I was a liar, a cheat, a thief. I was manipulative, and I didn't trust you. And that's who I was in relationships. And everything that I am and everything that I have is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys. And, you know, like I said, God's put me in a position where he can use me today. And the neat thing about this program is after we work the steps, there's so many different things to do in this program that we could never get bored. We can sponsor people. We can be of service in meetings. We can do H&I commitments. We can do GSR stuff. There's people here tonight I know are way more equipped to talk than me. And I have to thank you for tolerating me for 45 minutes or whatever. But, you know, I was thinking on the way out here that we should have an open meeting where everybody could talk. I love going to conventions, and I know after speakers and after whatever, we like to sit down and talk. It's not all just listening to one person. I know that no matter what I do in here, that I feel the best when I stay out of my own way, when I'm not full of myself, when I'm not all locked up in my head, and I get that way. I've been sober since October 10th of 1984. And when I came in here, I thought I'd hang out for a year because that's what the big book said. Nobody who's a real alcoholic can stay sober anything like a year. So I was going to do a year. I was going to turn 21, and then I was going to leave. Having found him, of course, because you got to have him. So I, you know, 30 days sober, moved in with him, and there we were. And sometime in between that commitment of hanging out here for a year with you guys and actually having a year sobriety, what I realized was that there's no place I belong like I belong here. I fit here, and no matter what I do, my skin feels okay here. I love this program. And most of the time, you know, there's a lot of newcomers that are in meetings, and you guys know. You know the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know that there's just absolutely nothing like one drunk talking to another one, you know. One of my old-timers was down south. His name was Frank Priest, and he had about almost 50 years when he passed away. And he was my absolute hero. And he used to tell me things like, you know, honey, the highest we get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober. There's no social climbers in here, you know. He said, my last name's Priest. If anybody's going to climb, it would have been me, baby. But he didn't. The highest we get is sober. And there's lots of different things that we can do if we get involved in the traditions. I love the traditions. I think, you know, they told me when I was new, the steps are to the individual, what the traditions are to the group. My sponsor told me that I had to take those traditions and internalize them and make them personal to me. So where tradition 5 says that we have one primary purpose, what that really means to me is that I have one primary purpose. And I was the one wandering around wasted earlier in my life going, what's my purpose? Why did you put me here? And I found it here with you guys. There's nothing like sharing in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's nothing like being here with you guys. I don't know. I love this program, and I could go on forever. I should skip the drunk part and start backwards, and I'd probably never get to it because all of the juice is in the sober part, is in the being of service, in the being with you guys, and being relationships with other people, and learning to know God. You know, that's an awesome thing. And one of my favorite things in Alcoholics Anonymous is to watch new guys come in and see the lights come on. You know, we moved up here 3 years ago from Southern California, and all the people that watched my lights come on aren't here. So sometimes I think I can fool you a little bit. So I got to go down south and let them humble my ass. I don't know. There's nothing like Alcoholics Anonymous. So I know there's a few people new in here, and what I would encourage you to do is stay here and work the steps. You know, do the deal. They told me don't leave before the miracle happens. And since then, I've heard don't leave after the miracle happens either. See, because I can come in here, I can work the steps, I can do everything that I'm supposed to do, and then I can wander off and do my life. I can get busy in work and relationships and doing all of these other things and not find time for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've done that. And what I find is when I'm not here with you guys, the miracle stops. I can be successful in my life. I can make a lot of money. I volunteer with the U.S. Naval Sea Cadet Corps, and I go to these naval bases today, and they don't know who I am. And all of those officers send their kids to me for the summer. And, you know, they just don't know. They have no idea. I can go out there and pass for normal, but when I'm not in here with you guys, I tend to forget. And I'm not normal. I'm far from normal. I don't know. I love this program, and I'd again like to thank you guys for letting me speak this evening. And thank you for coming and having your pre-conference assembly here. It's an honor to host you guys. Thanks.